Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
I said your mind is a devil, and I say, yeah, your mind is a devil, and a saint.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Shannon Wurst? Y'all like Shannon? Northwest Arkansas singer-songwriter Shannon Wurst has won multiple awards and accolades for her work, including an Arkansas Governor's Fellowship Award, a Kerrville New Folk Finalist, and a semifinalist in Garrison Keillor's Prairie Home Companion Talented 20s Contest. More can be found at shannonwurst.com. All right, well, welcome to a special edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in beautiful Bentonville, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Timonos Publishing Company, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. What do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Along with our Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox, which are the pieces right in the middle, we also feature an artist from the area when we go on location. So tonight's featured artist is Eureka Springs artist Ken Addington, who is represented by 225 South Main right here in Bentonville. And his are these pieces here and on the other side over there. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? It started with a journey, the ultimate road trip, to 1,000 destinations for one unforgettable exhibition. In 2013, Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art's curatorial team hit the road to investigate what's happening in American art today. Over the course of a year, the team logged more than 100,000 miles, crisscrossing the United States to visit nearly 1,000 artists. Traveling to communities large and small, the museum sought to discover artists whose work has not yet been fully recognized on a national level. On their travels, museum curators conducted hundreds of hours of one-on-one conversations with artists in their studios. The result of this unprecedented journey is a one-of-a-kind exhibition that draws from every region of the U.S., offering an unusually diverse look at American art. State of the Art brings together the artwork of more than 100 artists, ranging from works on canvas and paper to photography and video to installation and performance art and more. The exhibition examines ways in which today's artists are informed by the past, innovating with materials old and new, and engaging deeply with issues relevant to our times. We are thrilled to have on the show tonight State of the Art curator Chad Oligood, right down here. And two state-of-the-art artists, Susan Gothel Campbell and Pam Longobardi. So welcome all of y'all to Tales from the South. We're very excited to have y'all on tonight. Chad, I'd like to start with you. What an incredibly interesting journey that you took. So can you start by talking about the road trip itself, going place to place to meet these artists in their studios, and any stories that you might want to tell us about that?
Oh, sure. Well, a road trip is really putting it mildly. We're based here in Northwest Arkansas, and, you know, speaking of Tales of the South, I just noticed when I sat on this stage that I walked here tonight. I lived in downtown Bentonville, and I actually stepped in it on the way here. I don't know if it was a dog, I don't know if it was a deer, but, it's a good metaphor for our journey, because sometimes you don't know what you're going to find on the way, right? But you get on the stage, and here we are. The road trip across the country was really a kind of out-and-back thing every week. I'd fly out from XNA, Northwest Arkansas Airport, and connect somewhere and land in the Detroit area or the Atlanta area or the Omaha area. We'd rent a car, me and my co-curator, Don Bacigalupi, and we'd hit the road. We would stop at any number of artist studios and talk to them. Sometimes 8, 10, 12 a day, Monday through Friday. And then on Friday, we'd pack up and fly home and start again the next week. So it was an insane journey. I've got lots of frequent flyer miles that are still in the bank, ready to be used. That's happening this winter, by the way. That has to happen. You know, along the way, we met some great people, you know, like Susan and Pam. The exhibition really shows that. There's a kind of texture to artist studios that you don't necessarily get if you're standing in the exhibition. The exhibition, if I may say so, is pretty beautiful, thanks to y'all's work. But the studios, as you know, are not necessarily that beautiful sometimes. So, you know, when I think back along the journey, there, in fact, some of my most interesting visits came in the South. I'm from the South originally. I'm from a little town called Perry, Georgia. It's about 9,000 people. And it looks a little bit like Bentonville, Arkansas. A small town square, a courthouse on one side, a Confederate soldier in the middle. And so I identify with this place. And many of the small towns that and places that we were visiting across this country have their own unique character. The studios were the same way. When I visited Jackson, Mississippi, for instance, we can't know. So when we show up at an artist's studio, all we have is an address and a name. That's all you've got. And so you put it in the GPS and you cross your fingers and hope for the best. We would show up and sometimes it's a perfectly reasonable place. You know, Pam and Susan's happen to be perfectly reasonable, but there are a number of unreasonable places too. In Jackson, Mississippi, I showed up at this address. And we step out of our rental car. It's me and, if you can imagine it, an even nerdier curator. So my co-curator, Don Bacigalupi, he won't mind if I say that. Actually, don't tell him. We'd step out of our rental car, a generic Ford Focus, and here in Jackson at this address, we were at an abandoned Coca-Cola bottling plant. And to set the scene, there are empty bays with broken out glass windows. Weeds are overgrowing the parking lot. It's completely desolate. And tens of thousands of square feet of space that have previously been used in a kind of industrial way and are now completely barren. And Don looks at me, he's like, this is not the right place, right? And I said, no, I think this might be it. We walk in, and indeed it was. And we're walking in our curator shoes, you know, trying to look smart. And we were clearly not dressed for the occasion. And we walked into this abandoned plant, and indeed it was being used as a studio. Room after room of concrete floors and bare brick walls, dust in the air, plants growing through the floor. There was this really beautiful room that struck me. This gorgeous weed had emerged from the floor, totally luxuriating in the sunlight, showing off, really. And lining the walls were these really textured, beautiful paintings made of kind of found materials. Think of pallets and abandoned wood and wrapped up with that kind of string that you use to snap taut lines with. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know, like you snap a line to create a straight line. And he had wrapped them all with this blue string. Really incredible work made from almost nothing. And this guy was pretty clearly without a home. Had found a place, carved out a niche for himself within the texture of this community without any kind of materials or any wealth to work with whatsoever, and found a way to create. It was totally humbling and also incredibly inspiring. You know, those kinds of stories, they filter throughout the rest of our travels. That was Mississippi. I really enjoyed my travels through North Carolina, which is, you know, has such a rich and textured, beautiful environment, you know, beautiful mountains, and then near the coast you get really rocky coastline. So a lot of people working in a lot of different ways, responding to a lot of different things. And I rolled up in a little town called Spruce Pine, North Carolina. Anybody heard of Spruce Pine? Hey, I like that. Yeah, somebody's heard of it. I hadn't. I showed up there and went to the address, and all that was there was this little lean-to hut. And this time, Don wasn't with me. So Don was sort of my bodyguard. He's, 6'4" and, you know, a kind of a substantial dude. I'm not really. You can't see me because you're, you know, on the other side of the radio, but just letting you know. On this trip, I was by myself. I showed up here, you know, a little wary, but, you know, going with it. I've been to hundreds of studios at this point. this man wanders out in coveralls. I mean, I'm in the middle of nowhere. It's 8 o'clock on a November morning in the hills in North Carolina, and I'm, again, hoping for the best. He sort of waves me over and says, come on over, I got something to show you. And I go over there, and here is this huge block of marble that he has salvaged from a mistake in a pile of marble from a memorial carving facility. So places where they carve gravestones. They make mistakes sometimes. You don't think of that, but that happens. And something has to be done with that stone. Well, there's this guy, his name is Peter Glenn Oakley. He's working in the hills of North Carolina, and he makes incredibly refined marble sculpture out of these cast-off gravestones. It's in our galleries. There's a series of sculptures. One is a refined, beautiful stack of takeout boxes, and he's doing it all with his hands. And he's just working away all alone in spruce pine. And he took me through every stage of development, and let me tell you, it was incredibly inspiring. That was a consistent theme throughout our travels. In fact, meeting the unexpected and finding beauty in it is something that actually my two panelists up here really embody. When I showed up in Pam Longobardi's studio in Atlanta, Georgia, it's full of trash. I mean, right?
Yeah, it's full of trash.
Yeah, it's full of trash.
A particular kind of trash is plastic.
Yeah.
Ocean plastic.
And so, you know, I walked into your studio and I'm thinking, this lady's a mess, right? But you're not.
Right. Maybe I am.
Hopefully. I mean, we found that out.
Right.
And it's part of your practice to cull this sort of plastic ephemera from the world.
Well, I find this material from all over the world, and it's the plastic we use every day. And then it leaves our hands and we don't really know where it ends up, but most of it ends up in the ocean. And from there, it travels around the world. So, you know, here's a tale from the South. I first discovered this material in 2006 at the south point of the Big Island of Hawaii, which is the southernmost point in the United States. And at that location, there were piles and piles of plastic, multicolored plastic, household items, every kind of object you've ever seen in any location, you know, in any point of your life, and then things you've never seen before, giant, giant net balls of drift nets, multicolored flotillas bundled together. And this material I saw for the first time there. And on that location, I immediately felt in a way that I was entering a kind of crime scene, that there was some sort of crime against nature happening here. I felt like I had to document it. I had to pick it up and take that. And I found at that location almost every language on earth printed on this plastic material. So here's this kind of global South. You know, we are just a network of connectivity, and it's being revealed to us through this material that moves on the ocean currents, after it's moved through our hands, after it's moved through commerce. About a half of my studio or more is actually dedicated to this archive. So I have tens of thousands of objects now that are
She calls
literally
it an archive. I just saw piles of crap.
But they're fascinating. I mean, each one is telling a story, because it could be something that she played with as a child, or it could be something that kids are playing with now, or it could be something that is the Japanese McDonald's version of their, Happy Meals prize, or it could be something that comes from the inside of a machine. You know, there's a lot of plastic sort of hiding in everything.
Something you've never seen.
Exactly.
Yeah, so you said something really amazing to me that our studio visit, it changed my life, because it intersected with my daily life. But you said something to me that really made me think. Every single piece of plastic that has ever been produced still exists. You know, it still exists in our world. And so now I don't pick up straws. And that's
yay.
Yeah, that's a win. But, you know, it's such a small thing, but it means something, right?
Yeah, I think every single piece I pick up is one piece that's less that's going to damage a bird or hurt a turtle or end up in a whale's stomach. It's less one less piece that's going to, come back to haunt us in the way that it does. And so I think that this material really is describing to us a condition of the world. These objects travel across the seas for years sometimes, and by the time I find them, they've been changed by that journey. They're marked by nature. So they're either bitten by sharks or sea turtles or even crocodiles. So I have a whole part of my archive, which is the bite archive. It's true. I saw the crocodile that bit the piece that I found. It's a 15-foot crocodile in Costa Rica. So another southern location. But, you know, there's tons of things that grow on the plastic, too. And you know, I think that's what's sort of interesting about Susan's work, because she's allowing grass to grow inside of plastic forms, and I find that in a sort of naturally occurring state. I find seaweeds and barnacles and all kinds of shells and even small microscopic creatures growing inside and on that plastic. So when I saw her work in the exhibition, I was just floored, because it was so beautiful to me in a way that she was making a kind of inside imprint of, you know, these materials that I find in their kind of damaging state, and she's taking them and sort of growing new life inside of them.
Yeah, actually, it's funny when you said all this plastic winds up somewhere. A lot of it winds up in my studio, because I really like the shapes and the forms, and I use plastic containers as molds to grow grass that then becomes root-bound. And I invert it, and I'm interested in this, the idea of adaptation and how nature adapts. So when I saw Pam, what she was doing, it was so exciting to me, because I really am also thinking about plastic. There are certain shapes that I like, and I grow multiple units and make these large carpets and installations. And so as much as we don't want all this plastic around, there are times where I'm doing a large installation for an exhibition and I only have 3 containers of maybe Earthbound Farm lettuce, and I need to grow like 100 units so I can make this big expanse. And I particularly like the containers that Girl Scout cookies come in, especially tagalongs, because they have these really undulating ridges. So I had an exhibition coming up, and I only had 2 trays for tagalongs, and you can't get Girl Scout cookies just year-round. So this was in the fall, and I went online, and I actually then went to eBay, and I Googled, or I typed in tagalongs. So sure enough, somebody was selling tagalongs, and I spent $45 for only 3 boxes of cookies, just so I could have the plastic container. So I covet certain shapes. So the
were they expired?
They were. You know, they came in a styrofoam cooler, packaged exquisitely, because they probably thought I'm a connoisseur of cookies. And I just open them up and like just quickly get to planting my grass. They were not. They were kind of stale, actually.
You tried them.
I did.
Good for you.
Yeah. I ate them. I ate some of them, but no, I needed the containers.
Well, I have a lot of really weird plastic shapes, so we'll have to collaborate.
I think we will. I want to come look at your plastic collection. It would.
I found even plants growing in Alaska inside of big round net floats and things like that. So, yeah. Somehow it can grow on it. It's fascinating.
I would love to see the collaboration between the two of you, actually, because your studios are very different. So where Pam's studio, you know, and I don't mean to throw you under the bus here, Pam, but there's a lot of stuff in there. You guys should visit next time you go to Atlanta. And it fills all the corners. It's actually incredibly beautiful and textured and colorful, whereas Susan is such an admirable organizer, and she loves a minimal, clean, white look. So when you walk into her studio in Ferndale, Michigan, it's like stepping into some ethereal zone, and she knows exactly where everything is located. And she brought
up. Well, I do too.
Yeah, I'm sure that you do. Not a knock on Pam, but there was a moment where you brought out, Susan, this sculpture where you had captured dandelion fluff. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
It was encased in this, is it plexiglass box?
Yeah, actually, I collect ephemera. I do a series of work I call seasonals, and a lot of my work is a way to keep me engaged with what's happening outside. I'll do anything to just keep in touch with nature. And so in the spring, I'll harvest dandelion fluff, and I can mold it into a brick shape. And so it stays all by itself. You know, I don't have anything, maybe
holding
a touch
up.
Of hairspray, lasting hold, to be exact.
Really? You didn't
just
tell me that
bit.
In the studio?
I know. Yeah. Or cottonwood is another seed that I collect, and milkweed. Milkweed is amazing, just so buoyant. And so I make these objects, but I honor the inherent property of the material. So milkweed just wants to just lift, and a little static electricity, and it will just stay buoyant indefinitely, it seems.
So Chad, I'm curious, which of the two studios did you visit first?
I believe I visited you, Pam, first. We tended to visit places that we were familiar with early on in the process to sort of get our bearings. So we started in Texas because Don was a curator there earlier in his career. Atlanta I was familiar with because I'm originally from Georgia. So we visited you, maybe October of 2013?
Yeah, it seemed like I didn't hear back from you for a year.
Yeah.
I think it was really in the beginning.
I'm so sorry about that. Yeah, it took a while. Well, but I had a lot of stuff to do, Pam.
I had no idea.
Yeah, and then Susan, I think I came to Detroit in the dead of winter.
I think you did. Yeah. And I have to say, I had just driven across the state, and I got there 30 minutes before you did.
Oh my God.
I was highly caffeinated, I know. And because
I remember
just,
you being buoyant,
I had
just like your dandelion fluff.
I had just installed an exhibition. And so one reason my studio did look really spare was because there wasn't any work there.
Oh.
And I thought,
so you're not just clean, you're just harried.
No, well, I have two spaces because I make prints, and that space has to be clean, and the other is more like a greenhouse and just stuff's floating all over the place. But it was all cleared out when you got there.
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So yeah, I visited Susan second. So if you imagine in the stretch of 1,000 studio visits, I would say Pam was probably in the 200 range and Susan was more in the 700 range. So,
okay.
Just to give you a sense of scale.
So did you were you thinking that they were going to be similar in some ways or did you not have...
These two artists?
Right, before,
oh my goodness.
Before you met them and before you went to the studios.
No clue. And to be quite honest with you, I would review a list of... We sent out so many requests for suggestions of artists to visit before we touched down in a place. Then we would call them down and say, okay, I can see 50 this week. And then we would prioritize based on that list. And then we would crazily get in touch 2 days before we were in town, right? And say, can you make time for us? What was that like, actually, to get that email from us? Had you even heard of Crystal Bridges or who?
No, not at all. And the email just floated in kind of out of the blue. And because it seemed, it was cloaked in mystery. There was a lot of,
I am a man of mystery.
vagueness about it, but it just sounded really interesting. And so, I was, of course, excited to meet you, and then our conversation was so interesting, and then I didn't hear anything for like a year, so I sort of thought, well, I guess that was just an interesting visit. But then I had no idea what the scale and scope of this exhibition curatorial research was really about until it finally kind of became revealed. I think that was sort of this whole mystery that was built into the way the show unfolded.
Yeah. You know what? I didn't really know either. So I was hired for this project. And when someone says, you're going to visit studios all over the country, I'm like, yeah, that sounds great. When they say, actually, it's 1,000 and you're going to need to do it in 9 months. And could you leave now and just start? That's when you realize what the scale is about. So, I didn't communicate it to you because, quite frankly, I didn't know, right? But yeah, so, you know, further and further the process sort of emerged. And, you know, to your question about whether I was thinking of these two artists together, that answer is absolutely not, because I had a morass of other artists in my brain that I was trying to make sense of. But there was something about both of these powerful, amazing artistic practices that stuck with us and that would make sense in the context of this exhibition. And you hear the sparks that are sort of flying between the way that their work happens. And that's the real magic of the show, I think.
Well, we have a few minutes here at the end for audience questions.
So this question's for Chad. I wanted to know, what are some examples of pieces that got cut from the show that you wanted to include?
To say that something got cut, I mean, this is funny, actually. So to make sense of everything, to keep track, at the end of each trip, Don and I would be on two planes together, so you always have to connect to get to Northwest Arkansas. We would sit together and we would go through the list of artists that we had visited, and we would come up with a three-word mnemonic that would, 1,000 visits later, that would bring back their practices. So it's kind of like a haiku thing. Like, what evocative words will bring back Pam's or Susan's practice back to your brain? So I'd love to go back and get the specific ones.
That's so fascinating. Yeah, I want to know.
So we'll do that. We'll do that. But, I mean, you know, with Pam, it's something... something probably like found plastic assemblages, although it must have had a kind of environmental thing too, because that's so important to your work. And with Susan, I believe I was so struck with your dandelion fluff, and I had never seen anyone working with it before, that it may have just been dandelion fluff wow. So to keep everybody straight, you know, we had these, all of these notes, and then we would come back, and Don had this huge, you know, 8-foot map of the United States on his wall, and we would go through the list of people that really struck us, that stuck with us for whatever reason. We would make, you know, there's the full-size Post-it and then the little mini Post-it. We'd take the mini Post-it and then write their name, and then we'd stick it on the city where they came from. Did you guys know about this?
No.
Okay, yeah.
So great.
So, and then, you know, we'd stick it on the city, and then if there were people that were sort of on the fence, maybe, we stuck them out in the Pacific Ocean. So those people we called in the water. And so... So, and sometimes those people came out of the water. You know, if we met an artist whose work really resonated with another artist who was in the water, maybe they came together. Maybe it made sense to put them in context in the show together. And sometimes people were saved from the water by a lifeguard, essentially. And then sometimes people came off the map and into the water and actually just straight off the map altogether. I hesitate to share specific pieces that ultimately ended up off the map, but suffice it to say that I could have curated 10, 12, 20, 50 exhibitions from the number of artists and works that I saw over the course of this year. And indeed, that will form the part of my exhibition practice for years and probably decades to come, because I met any number of people, 2 of the 1,000 that you met tonight, whose career and work has so much texture and life to it, and this is just the beginning.
Both of you have kind of avant-garde mediums that you're working in, and I'm wondering how you got to that. Were you trained in art, like through college or whatever, or were you in some other pursuits and then got just drawn into art through what you saw going on in the world around you?
I actually do have a background in art, but also in science. And I would say the thing that's most manifested in my practice now really is this kind of intersection between art and science, but is as a way of looking at the natural world. So, for example, my husband and I spent the day today finding fossils all over here, you know, and it's basically, you know, I think when I'm finding this plastic, what I'm looking at are future fossils. So these are the things that are going to be part of the fossil layer, and truly they've actually come up with a new name for the era that we have entered now, which is the Anthropocene. So this is the new geologic era that the scientists that decide the geologic age of the Earth have decided that we've now entered this era because it is, we have altered the natural world in such a way. And really, for me, the hallmark object of that is plastic. So today we spent time thinking about time, and I'm super curious if anybody knows what the geologic age is of the ground, the rubble here. I mean, we found fossils in the broken up rocks in the parking lot. I mean, it was incredible. You guys are just in fossil heaven here.
Yeah, it's a rocky place, and the soil and the ground is broken up by any number of natural springs, one of which is here on the property. The Crystal Spring gives rise to all the water that you see here. So there are so many waterways that break up the soil and break up the rock and release those fossils that you're talking about. But we'll connect you with some scientists down at the University of Arkansas, and we'll make it happen. Let's do it.
To answer your question, I am trained. I went to a liberal arts college, and then my graduate work is in printmaking. And I still make traditional prints. I'm very interested in landscape, but for me, I needed to reach way beyond that and think about landscape as it is linked to environment. So my work that has moved into ephemera, crowdsource projects, things like that, I'm really interested in trying to find ways to link people with local and global environments. So I've really my practice is quite interdisciplinary now, but I do make traditional woodblock prints as well.
Really quickly for the artist, could you just summarize in a few sentences your body of work from your earliest works to your current work that you make?
I'm really interested in this idea of the urban sublime and the paradox of beauty. And I've spent most of my adult life in Detroit, and I have been fascinated with power plants and industry. Not only are they stunningly beautiful, their emissions, but they're also quite toxic and nasty. So my earliest work were very realistic renderings of industry, and I've moved out from that.
But it relates to your background. So, I mean,
most definitely. Yep.
Your background is in printmaking, which is the literal imprint of a thing on a piece of paper, right? It's like, it's proof that something has happened. And in your latest series of works, this sort of crowdsourcing thing where you're sending out air filters all over the globe and asking people to put them somewhere dirty.
Right. I have this project called Dirty Pictures, Portraits of Air that I've done in three different locations. The last one was in Pittsburgh, and really, the process of printmaking has informed everything that I do. So I'm actually collecting particulates, or I'm asking people to collect particulates, and I'm interested in that transference of material.
They're beautiful, Susan. I mean, and when you frame them, they look like spare, minimal, abstract prints. They're so gorgeous.
They're just
and they're
gradations.
In every color.
The most beautiful one is a filter that was placed near a meat smoker at a barbecue place. And it's got this beautiful patina on it. So I send these out to people, and then they send them back to me, and I exhibit them as filters of air, portraits of air. They're framed just like an 8x10 portrait.
Well, my earliest kind of drawing that I did was actually scientific illustration. So I also did very realistic works, and not surprisingly, I guess I drew dinosaur bones and coral. So I did that for money so that I could put myself through graduate school in art. And so I had the work that I did for myself, which was very different, but I was always looking at this kind of psychological relationship between humans and the natural world. And so from there, it moved to utilizing materials in my paintings that were stand-ins for nature. So I make, very elaborate paintings on copper with patinas that interact naturally with the copper, and that sort of stands for nature. And then the paint, which is the sort of cultural emblematic mark, that's sort of the human touch, I guess. And so those things exist in the paintings. And then, because of all this interaction between the natural forces of energy and physics and the things that are invisible even to our eye. I got really interested in phenomenological events, so, you know, things like reflection, magnetism, and that all kind of led it up to finding this plastic material, which really is all of that stuff. It's nature and culture in collision. And, you know, that I would say that's been the sort of underlying current of my work from the beginning.
So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you so much, Chad Alleygood, Pam Longobardi, and Susan Gothel Campbell for being on Tales from the South. Thank you to our live audience here at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Bentonville, Arkansas, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temino's Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by the Writers Colony at Dairy Hollow, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, Urban Garden Montessori, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio. You can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
This is a song that was written for a contest, for a jingle for the state of Arkansas.
This is called Nothing Like the Natural State. You got a place for you to stay and a place for you to go, things for you to do like see, bathhouse, sure we got hunting, fishing, antiques and crafts. We'll send you a map so you can get here real fast. You're welcome to stay a week or a month, yeah, we'd be glad to have you. Arkansas, nothing like the natural state. Drive a scenic parkway, Crowley's Ridge, run, walk, bike, hike that big damn bridge, watch the eagles fly at Mount Pettigene, or have a paranormal weekend in Eureka Springs, dig for diamonds at Crater, Diamond State Park, see Louisiana, purchase historic landmark, visit the birthplace home of Clinton and Holberg, go to Hever International and give a go. Nothing like the natural state, there's just something about the air that's great when you're rushing around and you need a break. There's nothing like Arkansas, nothing like the natural state.
Nothing like the natural state. writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhousenlr.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by Infrared Studio in North Little Rock. More at infraredstudioproductions.com. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive, and we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.